We have talked about it endlessly over the last decade or so, and we've accomplished close to zip.
We know enough about our climate problem to know that it's serious and that we need to get started right away.
What we're seeing right now is a clear loading of the weather dice.
And right here in the United States, in sunny California, water scarcity is about to become a fact of life. Big news, right? Earth-shattering, even. And guess what? Nobody in the mainstream media seems to care.
That's HuffPost TV talking about the lack of climate change coverage in your favorite TV newscast. Welcome back, everybody. I'm NPR News Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. 2015, right? Perhaps the most newsworthy year for climate change in history. It was the second consecutive hottest year on record globally. In fact, I heard from Michael Mann last night, prominent climate scientist, that last year was probably the warmest year in 1,300 years for planet Earth. It was also a record tropical cyclone year in the Northern Hemisphere. And we watched, of course, the historic climate agreements at the COP21 meetings in Paris. So you'd think it would be all over the news, right? Well, not exactly. A new study from Media Matters out this week says climate change coverage actually fell on network TV newscasts last year. One example, ABC News did a total of just 13 minutes of climate change coverage last year, and they interviewed precisely zero climate scientists on the network evening newscast, according to the study. So today on ClimateCast, why is climate change coverage often still hard to find on your local or network TV newscast? We've got some great guests today to drill down into that question. Ed Maybach is the director for the Center of Climate Change Communication at George Mason University near Washington, D.C. He's done some pretty extensive research on how your local TV meteorologists view climate change. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Paul.
And you know our other guest, of course, on ClimateCast today. He's a legendary TV news anchor, but he's also an actor, a writer, a radio host, an explorer, and believe it or not, he sings a mean blues. He's my former WCCO-TV colleague, Don Shelby. Don, it's so good to have you in the studio today.
Thanks, Paul. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Paul.
Don, let's start with you, your days at WCCO-TV. You were kind of an early adopter, shall we say, a pioneer, and you actually used sort of an investigative approach to climate change reporting, right?
Well, people remember me primarily. First of all, hi, Ed. How you doing?
Good, Don. Thanks. How are you?
It's great to hear your voice. The people remember me as an anchor primarily, mm-hmm. but they forget that for 30 years I cut my teeth and made my bones as an investigative journalist and taking on some fairly large systematic as well as individual criminal cases.
Mm-hmm.
And so 25 years ago, I did not know whether climate change was real or not. I was in the vast majority of the American population. They did not know.
Sure.
Scientists were fairly certain at the time among those people who were studying it as climatologists and oceanographers. But the press certainly didn't know. And there was just no evidence that we could wrap our brains around. And that means there are no real scientific reporters in a daily newsroom of any size and downward to the lowest markets. And so the scientific process was confusing. Everybody has an arts degree of some
right,
kind.
Right, that's right.
And they're not steeped in science. They took the arts path because they didn't want to deal with science.
And this would have been what, late 80s, 90s?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and so my first report that that global warming was real, and I have to talk about global warming and climate change because the two terms are interesting. My report said global warming is what is happening, and climate change is what happens as a result of global warming. And it wasn't, as some people on the other side would say, was an attempt to change the language to soften it.
Sure.
But what we did was approach it as an investigative report.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a null hypothesis in every investigative report if you're going to be objective, and that is to start with nothing really happened. Nothing occurred. And then you start building some facts. And so if you are presented with the supposition that the mayor has a hand in the cookie jar, then you begin with that no one has their hand in a cookie jar. Now we have to establish whether any money is missing. Now we have to establish whether that's an accounting error. Now we have to establish, if it is not an accounting error, somebody is taking money. Now we have to establish who that is. We don't start with the mayor has his or her hand in the cookie jar.
And so you took that same approach.
Same
with
approach, exactly.
Change.
Yes. And so what it was a gathering of evidence. Now, here was the big difference.
Mm-hmm.
Because in science, as I was being taught my science by some of the greatest scientists working today, they were telling me that you can't reach basically a moral certainty on science. And that's the benefit of good science,
mm-hmm.
that we're always trying to defeat the next new hypothesis.
Sure. So it's a skeptical process.
That's right. It is very conservative in its nature. And so we approach that from the point of view of what is known in legal parlance and civil litigation as preponderance of evidence. And instead of trying to reach a moral certainty, which we knew we could not do scientifically, we tried to just stack up the evidence on one side and use peer-reviewed materials and used a lot of the work that went into the Merchants of Doubt, because I was in touch with Naomi Oreskes early on.
Sure.
So 2 years before An Inconvenient Truth hit the air, then I went on television with an investigative report and said that it's very, very likely happening. And here's the preponderance of the evidence that stacks up on the peer-reviewed side. And peer-reviewed basically through journals like Science and Nature.
And let me just jump in. Was anybody else reporting on climate change in local TV news at that time?
Derivative reports. And my goal when I sat down with the people at WCCO-TV was to say that my hope is that after 5 years of doing this, 800 stories later, mm-hmm. that what would happen is the one story a month that was appearing in the St. Paul papers and the Minneapolis papers that had anything to do with climate change would change to one story a week, then would change to one story a day. And it is about one story a day now as I follow the newspapers. So that target has been hit. People are talking more about it, but it is still a problem with what is, Ed knows very well, is false balance, which is a, and now I'm going to have to come down a little hard on some of my friends who are working journalists and who have been working journalists in the past. False balance is a crutch because there's a three-legged stool in journalism of accuracy, fairness, and balance, and that replicates objectivity. But what happens when you don't know what you're talking about? And 99.9% of reporters sent out to cover global warming issues don't know a thing about it.
Yeah.
And so what they're forced to do is rely on balance. It's kind of a cheat. So you take someone who believes in the science of global warming, and you get 30 seconds of their sound, mm-hmm. or in the newspapers, you get 5 column inches of their quotes. Then in balance, you feel it's absolutely necessary to go to the other side, the people who don't believe in the science or have a different idea of the science, and get another 5 column inches of quotes and another 30 seconds. Well, that's balance, but it is not true balance because that's not the way the scientific community lines up.
And a great example would be cigarettes, to try to find stories that say there isn't a link with lung cancer. We know the science doesn't support that. I want to jump to Ed real quick and get you in here, Ed. You know, Don's obviously a journalist, an anchor, a reporter, and I know you've surveyed my peers in TV weather. What does your work tell us about how local TV meteorologists report on climate change?
Yeah, well, on that front, I have some fairly cheerful news.
Oh, good. We can use it.
Yeah, I've been working with colleagues in your broadcast meteorology community pretty closely now for the past 6 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And we conduct an annual survey of broadcast meteorologists. We track what they're doing in terms of their efforts to educate their viewers about the local impact of climate change. And that's a really important opportunity that they have. You know, most people have a difficult time understanding the enormous scope of a global problem that we call global climate change.
Well, and most meteorologists are the only scientist on the air at the station. That's an important point, too.
And the only scientist that most of the people will ever contact.
That's
exactly
true.
Right. Yeah. And so they have a really extraordinary opportunity to educate their viewers about the local consequences of a global problem. 6 years ago, there really wasn't too much going on when we tried to find weathercasters around the country who were actively taking steps to educate their viewers, and we only managed to find less than two dozen, coast to coast. Fairly small number. That's two dozen out of about 2,000 working broadcast meteorologists. But today, the community has really come along. In part, it's because we've helped to develop materials that help local broadcasters tell the story about how climate change is influencing their weather and other things in their community. But I think in part it's because, you know, members of the broadcast meteorology community now sort of understand this is their role. Reporting the doing the 72-hour forecast is certainly the core of their job and what most viewers want from them, but helping their viewers understand the fact that the change in our climate is also changing our weather. Lots of broadcasters seem to understand now that that is really an important part of their role, that they have a unique opportunity to do it, and they're rising to the occasion. So just to sort of put a fine point on it, we from what was a couple of dozen 6 years ago, we now know of at least 320 around the country who really are making a game effort at trying to educate their viewers about the local consequences of climate change.
And I think that's great progress, I do, but I want to touch on this point for a minute, because I did TV weather for 20 years here in Minneapolis, Arizona, and Chicago. I used to report on climate change quite often since the late 90s, but I've been told by more than one local TV meteorologist that news managers, and in some cases ownership, has actually told them not to cover climate science in their weathercasts. And you know, some meteorologists or owners may feel that climate change is like kryptonite for TV weather people. It might alienate part of their audience. So there's that. There one dynamic of the weathercasters want to report on this. There's another dynamic of news managers saying, "Oh no, you don't." I'm interested in both of your perspectives on this, Don. Why don't you jump in first?
We lost when we began doing climate coverage, and finding that the preponderance of evidence showed that it was human caused, caused by greenhouse gases, caused by land use, and a number of other factors. That we lost a large percentage of our audience overnight.
Really?
Overnight. We lost a large percentage.
How did
of
you
our
find
audience.
Out about? I mean,
because
was it
we have overnight
calls,
ratings.
Okay.
Overnight ratings.
Seriously.
And you could just see. And then it became very clear to me that I suddenly became here in town, according to two different radio personalities. DFL Don. DFL Ed is the Democratic Party in Minnesota. And so it became an ideological battle. I was trying to find the facts.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's, I came into this not really caring. I didn't come into this as a liberal environmental Democrat saying I'm going to show something that would benefit that ideology. I just wanted to find out whether it was true or not. And it's always been my supposition that the role of a journalist is to say, know this and proceed,
mm-hmm.
not tell them how to proceed,
right?
But say, these are the facts, and you can't carry on in the same way you did before you had the facts.
Exactly.
These facts have to have some impact on you. But Ed well knows that the studies at Michigan and Maryland have shown that facts really don't count when the ideology is so strong. So if you have a confirmation bias and the facts fit your bias, mm-hmm. then you're going to accept completely whatever that reporter says. If you have an ideology that disagrees and that ideology is deep-seated, you're going to reject the facts, and actually the facts that you present work against you. So it's sort of a Gordian knot that makes it very difficult to untie.
Or a Shelby knot.
A Shelby knot, yes. But you just keep trying, and you just keep pounding, and you just keep saying that it's true, and try to take it out of the ideological spectrum, and try to find some common ground. And I found common ground among conservatives and liberals, and that common ground was not in the science of climate change, but was in the area of waste. And that way I could bring both sides together, because both sides hated waste. One side hated waste because they hated waste in government spending, mm-hmm. and one side hated waste in resources and energy. And even though I understand the physics that you can't waste energy, but the energy is still there, trying to explain science to people who don't have a science education is very difficult.
Oh, tell me about it. That's where I live, Don.
I know you do.
And listen, there's a lot of smart people out there in our audience, of course, very well educated for the most part as well. Ed, I want to get your take on this thread. What are your thoughts?
So if a news director feels that his or her on-air talent should never say anything that would upset a single viewer, and I've heard that. I've had plenty of weathercasters tell me that their news directors do tell them that. That's pretty unrealistic, frankly. I mean, you know, America's a big, diverse place. We have lots of points of view. One of the things that I try to help the weathercasters I work with understand is that about 9 out of 10 Americans, and you know, there's a little bit of variance from community to community, but not all that much, but about 9 out of 10 people, they'd really like to learn more about climate change. Most Americans just don't know much about the issue, and 9 out of 10 people have an open mind. They'd like to learn interesting, relevant, particularly locally relevant information. And a really stunning statistic from our surveys is that the majority of Americans say they hear about global warming or climate change at most once a month, at most.
Wow.
So coming back to Don's comments earlier about sort of the frequency with which this issue is covered in the news media, we're not there yet. And, you know, the Media Matters report that you opened with is certainly a testament to that. You know, how can national news coverage of this issue be declining when, in fact, our scientific certainty that this this phenomenon, you know, a phenomenon that is born of physics and chemistry and biology, you know, it's remaking our world around us today. It's you know, quite arguably the biggest challenge that we face currently, possibly the biggest challenge human civilization has ever faced. And why national news media coverage of it isn't skyrocketing, that's a really important question.
Well, and go ahead, Don.
I was just going to say, Ed, do you think that part of the reason is the analysis is being left out of all of this because it has taken just the term climate change and kind of has worn itself out, like the term sustainability and some other terms that really, you say it over and over again, it just doesn't have any meaning. And they go, oh, yeah, you're talking about climate change again. I'm turning off or I'm not listening. Or those people who do listen are often hearing the same thing said over and over again. The question of externalities really interests me. It's what if we don't do anything to affect this in the terms of public policy, that it's going to cost us an awful lot, not just in terms of human lives and disease and mosquito vectors and rising sea levels and melting glaciers and all of the things that we hear so often, but the other externalities that even the business communities are looking at very, very closely. And GE, obviously, leading the fray, and also Swiss Re and Munich Re,
that's
all the
right.
Reinsurers
the
are coming in. DOD is coming in. And these are not exactly conservative liberal organizations.
That's right.
These are very conservative business people. And they're saying this is the something we have to look at because we're seeing the statistics pile up on the wrong side of our budget line, and we're getting killed over here.
And the risk models are actually changing for the insurance industry.
Absolutely.
Because of catastrophic extreme weather increases. And, Don, we don't need to look any farther than the Twin Cities. I was just at the Climate Adaptation Conference about 6 weeks ago. Best Buy, General Mills, 3M, all completely on board with climate sustainability efforts. General Mills saying, you know, we've been in business 150 years. This is their 150th anniversary. Congratulations, General Mills. And they're saying, you know, you don't need to tell us climate change is happening. You don't need to convince us. We see it in our supply chain. We can't grow cocoa in West Africa anymore. Where can we grow cocoa? So these companies are not only focused on this, and they're not only doing these because it's a philanthropic sort of effort.
It's good business.
It's changing their business model. So
yes.
It's good business to do that.
Absolutely.
Ed, what do you think?
Be more specific, Paul.
Yeah. Well, just on this thread of climate change, the information getting out there in the media, and then the wider absorption of that by not only the public, but corporations and insurance areas that we're seeing, like Don talked about.
Yeah, no, I'm in full agreement that, you know, it's no longer a matter of if we will respond to this challenge. It's really a matter of when, how quickly will we respond, and different parts of society are responding at different rates. The corporate sector is, you know, really pretty far ahead of the political sector on this one. You know, you just don't see major corporations engaged in sort of a silly debate about whether or not this is happening. They know it's happening, and they're very interested in protecting their bottom lines and building the kind of company that will thrive in the future. And that's exactly the kind of decision-making that we need in every community in America. You know, all of our communities need to be thinking about and talking about what is it going to take for us to thrive in the future. We, you know, that's all we want for ourselves and for our neighbors and for our loved ones. And that's exactly the kind of thinking and discussion that will really help accelerate the kinds of solutions that will not only prevent the worst of climate change, but quite importantly, will actually improve our living conditions, you know, in our communities today. So the more quickly we pivot away from dirty fuels running our economy and towards clean renewable energy, the more quickly we will clean up our air and our water, because dirty fuels are highly polluting, and that pollution ultimately hurts our health in the short term as well as in the long term. So the more we can accelerate the transition to clean energy, the more quickly we will all benefit in terms of, you know, the health of our children, our elderly parents, our those among us who already suffer from chronic diseases of a variety of sorts.
I have about 30 seconds left here on Paul's show, but I just wanted to mention that I heard Bob Inglis, Congressman Bob Inglis out of South Carolina, who was voted out by the Tea Party after 16 years in Congress, and he believes in the science of climate change, and he believes that a carbon tax is the proper way to go. And it was a wonderful conversation, but it was made better when Ken Powell, the president of General Mills, came up and said, "What are they going to tell us this? Because all of my suppliers, everybody in my chain in the business wants that carbon tax, because that way they can internalize the externality. They can figure it as part of their business plan, and it just seems to be a solution that's out there, but the ideologies in this country have separated us so far that no one is thinking clearly."
Hey, you know, great conversation today, guys. Thank you so much. Ed Maybach from George Mason University, thank you so much for your excellent insight today.
Thank you, Paul.
And Don, I would be remiss if I didn't let our audience know that, in the spirit of full disclosure, you and I have been playing in the WCCO-TV Blues Band for, what, the past 25 years?
Yes, we have.
So on that note, I thought it would be appropriate. Let's take you out today, and thanks so much for being here with a doubly apropos Stevie Ray Vaughan version of "The Sky Is Crying."
Oh, really? You can listen to this, Ed.
The sky is crying. Pennies and the tears roll down the street. The sky is crying. Pennies and the tears roll down the street.